Hello, I'm glad you could join us here again on PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall, and this episode is all about synapsids. Yes, as an arthropod worker, I'm well out of my comfort zone on this one, but that's what this show is all about, learning about past life. So, if this is your first time joining us, welcome, it's great to have you here. I had to do a fair bit of reading to prepare myself for this episode, and yet there was still a lot of my own mispronunciations and confusion of terminology that got left on the cutting room floor. So, make sure you head over to our website, where you can see the images, diagrams, and phylogenetic trees that show a lot of the information about which we're talking. If you enjoy this episode, get onto social media and do the usual like, share, subscribe, and comment, and you can always submit any episode requests there too. Looking ahead, we've got some great interviews lined up for next month, including an exclusive interview about a new Eurypterid or sea scorpion, which you all know I'm very excited about. And we'll also be reporting from the annual Symposium of Vertebrate Paleontology and Comparative Anatomy, or SVPCA, from the University of Southampton. So we hope you can join us again then, but until that time, please enjoy hearing a little about your own evolutionary history. And joining us here is Neil Brocklehurst. Thanks for joining us, Neil.
No problem.
You're currently a postdoc at the Museum for Naturkunde in Berlin, aren't you? How did you get there and how did you start working on synapsids?
Well, I didn't actually learn very much about early synapsid evolution when I was an undergrad. They were somewhat neglected, but what really attracted me to the project that was offered by Jörg Froebisch at the museum was his work on the end-Permian mass extinction. He used a lot of exciting methods to show what was really happening in terrestrial ecosystems at this time, and I read a few of his papers about these wacky little critters that I didn't really know very much about, but it was more the questions he was asking that interested me rather than the animals. So I just felt I wanted to work with him on a lot of the issues that he was interested in. But I will say now I've done a 3.5-year PhD project on early synapsids. I wouldn't want to swap them for anything. There's this just huge array of Permian weirdness that I've never really looked into before. And yeah, I love them.
Yeah, I've never really looked into it before either. So in that respect, can we have a brief overview of the different groups of vertebrates that are around at this time? So we're going to be talking about synapsids, pelycosaurs, mammals, theraspids, amniotes, tetrapods. There's so many different groups. Can we have a little introduction to each one?
Right. Well, starting from the larger groups and working inwards, the tetrapods are the four-limbed vertebrates, so basically any vertebrate that's not a fish. Today they include the amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals, but there's a huge diversity of now extinct taxa on the stem of the lineage, and this really blurring the boundaries between fish and tetrapod. Then we go on to the amniotes. These are the fully terrestrial tetrapods. They have what's called the amniotic egg, which, amongst other things, gave them full independence from water. You know, amphibians, even those, there are several which spend almost all their time on their lands, they still have to lay their eggs in water. The eggs can't dry out since they have a permeable membrane. But amniotes have a variety of structures inside their eggs to allow gas exchange, but also prevent the embryo from dying out and deal with waste. So it allowed vertebrates the sort of final severing of their link with water. The amniotes first appear in the Carboniferous about 315 million years ago, and they split into two lineages, the synapsids and the sauropsids. The sauropsids have gone on to give us the reptiles and birds in the present day, while synapsids are today represented by the mammals. But the synapsids I work on aren't mammals. I work on the earliest evolution of the lineage during the Carboniferous and Permian, so from about 300 to 250 million years ago. And I'm particularly interested in what are called the pelycosaurs. They're six families at the very, very base of the synapsid lineage. They're also called the mammal-like reptiles. They include people's favorites like Dimetrodon and Edaphosaurus, the sailback reptiles, and they absolutely dominated terrestrial ecosystems during the early Permian. But then in the late Permian, they're replaced by a group called the therapsids, which, shall I say, are the more mammal-like of the mammal-like reptiles.
Right.
And they include the lineage which ultimately gives rise to mammals.
Okay, so what do we as mammals have in common with the theraspids and the pelycosaurs that the sauropsids don't?
Well, the big characteristic, the one that's always trotted out as the definition of synapsids, is a single temporal fenestra, so a hole in the skull behind the eye. Diapsids, the group that includes all living reptiles and birds, have two of these holes, but synapsids only have one. I probably should say before people start poking holes in their heads is that in some therapsid groups and mammals themselves, there's a bone called the sphenoid that has closed this fenestra. It's still there, but it's covered.
Is that like where our temples are or something?
Yes.
All right.
Yeah, just behind your eyes.
I could be a vertebrate worker after all this.
Possibly. Another feature that you'll find talked about a lot, even in the very early basal synapsids, is that mammals and basal synapsids have a lot of tooth differentiation. Even the basal pelycosaurs have quite a variety of teeth. They have canines and some have grinding tooth plates. And then when we get into the therapsids, you start finding molars and premolars and incisors. There are reptile groups that show tooth differentiation, but it's usually to a much lesser extent.
Hmm.
And a final and slightly controversial issue is thermoregulation. So mammals, I'm sure everyone knows, are warm-blooded. They can control their own body temperature, whereas reptiles are cold-blooded. They rely on the environment to heat them up. A slight problem is that no one's really sure when this evolved. So we have difficulty knowing when fur appeared, as it doesn't usually fossilize. And then we have some of these pelycosaurs that have the big sail on their back that people have been that have suggested was used for thermoregulation and increase their surface area to allow them to heat up more quickly. But we don't know. And there's some really interesting work that's coming out on bone histology, which is suggesting that thermoregulation may have actually evolved really early on in synapsids, even in some of the more supposedly primitive synapsids.
Well, that's really interesting. How can you use bone histology as a proxy for thermo... what was it called?
Thermoregulation. I'm not an expert on this. I really don't know an awful lot about bone histology, but it's to do with, you can tell the growth history of an animal by looking at its bone histology. But yeah, that's something that I'm not an expert on. This is work by one of my colleagues in Germany, Christian Shelton.
So what characters separate the later therapsids from the earlier pelycosaurs?
Well, in general, the therapsids are seen as more mammal-like than the pelycosaurs. They have a specialized femur, which allows a more upright stance, and they have increased flexibility of the neck. They have a skull strengthened by the fusion of various bones, so we don't see as much of the cranial kinesis, the movement of different bones that we see in pelycosaurs. And there's a lot more specialization of the teeth. There's enlarged canines in both the upper and lower jaw, and we have incisors that interlock. And it's also been suggested that the soft secondary palate, which we find in mammals and which separates your nasal cavity from your mouth, which allows you to breathe while you're eating, may have evolved quite early on in therapsids, but that's a bit uncertain. And to be honest, this really highlights one of the problems we have when looking at therapsid evolution, is that we don't really know what the basal therapsid looks like. We see therapsids in the Middle Permian already really derived. And apart from a couple of vertebrae that have been very recently published by Frederick Schwindler from the late Carboniferous, we don't really have any idea what therapsids were doing in the Carboniferous and early Permian. So we don't know if all these characters appear gradually over a long period of time, and we just don't have the fossil record of it, or whether the sudden appearance of all these derived therapsids actually represents a very sudden and very rapid radiation.
So in a recent paper, you've taken a look at some of the long-term patterns in synapsid diversity. Can we start off by clarifying what you actually did in this project? Was it a case of simply counting up all the different species at any given time and plotting that in a little graph?
Well, that used to be how it was done, but that isn't really passing muster anymore. The problem is what I was just talking about. The fossil record is incomplete, and that's always been known. I don't think anyone's ever disputed that, and I mean, we even find Darwin talking about it in The Origin of Species. Not every species will leave a fossil, and those that will generally be incomplete, so we can't get the full picture of each species. There's loads of areas still unexplored, so we haven't found every fossil. So this has always been acknowledged, but it was only in the 70s, really, that people started looking at what they can actually do about it. And now people are starting to acknowledge that not only is the incompleteness of the fossil record testable, we can actually show whether a particular group has a particularly biased record, but it's also correctable. We can actually try and remove the sampling bias from the record. So there's a variety of statistical methods we can use to fill in the gaps in the record, so to speak.
And so what are some of these considerations?
Well, for early synapsids specifically, we have one very obvious problem, which is the Permian terrestrial record is heavily local. The early Permian terrestrial record, which is where we find most of our pelycosaurs, comes almost entirely from North America and Western Europe. And I think it was Romer in 1940 who pointed out that 90% of pelycosaur specimens come from an area of Texas about 100 miles in diameter. Things have improved since his day, but the early Permian is still almost entirely known from North America and Europe. But then when we go to the middle and late Permian, we suddenly find our therapsids, the North American record vanishes, and we're finding most of our fossils from Russia and South Africa. So here we're not just having the problem that certain areas aren't being sampled. We have entire climate zones that are missing. Our early Permian terrestrial record is limited to areas that were hovering around the equator at that time, whereas the middle and late Permian record is mostly what was then temperate regions. And we only have a short period of overlap between the North American and Russian record.
So why is this the case? Is it simply that there aren't those rocks in those different continents, or is it simply that the Americans don't want to look at the later stuff and the Russians don't want to look at the earlier stuff? Or
well, to an extent, a certain extent, it is that there aren't the records. The above the early Permian American terrestrial record, we just get a load of marine formations, so we just don't have middle and late Permian North American terrestrial rocks. There are now being found later Permian equatorial, what was then equatorial, faunas in North Africa, but these have only really recently been sampled, so there's not as much that's come out of them yet. And there are a few early Permian potential terrestrial sites from places like South America that haven't been explored very much but are showing a bit of promise. But yeah, for the most part, it's just that we haven't found the rock formations.
So how can you quantify or estimate the number of species that would have been alive at this time? How do you go from a knowledge that there are no rocks of a Permian age in this locality to an estimate of perhaps maybe 40 species?
Well, there's a variety of statistical methods. For example, you can use the evolutionary trees. Now, these obviously show the relationships, the branching patterns, but they also show when species should have appeared. So if you have two lineages, one of which doesn't appear until later in the fossil record, but they are shown by the evolutionary tree to be sister taxa, then the one that appears later must have been present at least as far back as the one that is found earlier in the fossil record, because they must both have diverged from their common ancestor at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So you can infer what is called the ghost lineage, which is a lineage that we know was present at a particular time due to the phylogeny, but we just haven't sampled yet. And then there's more statistical methods that don't actually make specific assumptions about the taxa themselves. There's things like subsampling, where you can say, okay, I have this time period where we have five localities and another time period where we have 10 localities. So for the second time period, I'm just going to randomly pick five localities, so our sample size is the same. And you do that 1,000 times and take an average of the number of species you find. And so you can do that for entire time bins as well.
So having done that with the family tree of synapsids, what were the some of the larger scale patterns that you were able to see?
Well, synapsids first appear in the fossil record about 307 million years ago in Nova Scotia. However, the two synapsid species we know from this time are both derived. They cannot be the earliest synapsids, so we are missing an earlier record. Molecular dating suggests that synapsids should have split from sauropsids about 310 to 350 million years ago. So our earliest fossils are pretty close, about 307 million years ago. And then they radiate actually fairly rapidly. When we look at the phylogeny, we see all six of the major pelycosaur families have appeared by the end of the Carboniferous. And then pelycosaur diversity actually remains relatively stable for most of the early Permian. And it's not until sort of the boundary between the early and the middle Permian that we really see anything very different happening to them. They start declining and therapsids start radiating.
So what was happening environmentally at this time? Was there any environmental driving force behind that evolution and then radiation?
Well, the late Carboniferous and early Permian was very much a time of warming and drying. So during the middle and late Carboniferous, the environment in North America, which is, as I said, where we're finding most of these fossils, was tropical rainforest and swamp-like environment. It's what we call the coal swamps, since all the plants there have been fossilized as coal. But by the end of the Carboniferous, the rainforest has been reduced to just little islands of forest and is being replaced by a more savanna-like environment, so seasonally wet rather than constantly wet. And it's been suggested that this was the cause of the rise of the amniotes. Obviously, their amniotic egg would make them better suited to this situation than the amphibians. And we do see the diversification of the amniotes and a reduction in the diversity of amphibians coinciding with the rainforest collapse.
Do we have any idea about the disparity of the pelycosaurs? Not just the diversity, the number of individuals, but the number of different kinds of body shapes?
Well, there haven't been any proper quantitative analysis of synapsid morphological diversity during the Carboniferous and early Permian. So I don't want to make any definite statements about that, but I will say that by the end of the Carboniferous, we not only have the major families established, but we seem to have a fairly large number of morphotypes. We have small to medium-sized carnivores and insectivores like the Varanopids. We have some of the earliest terrestrial vertebrate herbivores in the Edaphosaurids. and some of the earliest terrestrial macrocarnivores in the sphenacodontids, those feeding on large vertebrate prey. We even have, at least possibly, this is disputed, a genus called Ophiacodon, which may have returned to the water and been a semi-aquatic predator. So all of this seems to have been in place by the end of the Carboniferous.
That does sound like quite a lot of the vertebrate niches. What were the other groups doing at the time? What were the sauropsids doing, the dinosaurs? Or the early dinosaurs?
Well, dinosaurs aren't around at this point yet, but
I can hear all the dinosaur workers just hitting the heads on the tables.
Yes, probably. Well, in the early terrestrial realm, in the early Permian, pelicosaurs really dominate immensely. I think with the exception of one sauropsid group called the Capsarhinids, there isn't really a great diversity of other reptiles. The pelicosaurs dominate in terms of species richness, in terms of morphological and ecological diversity, in terms of the simple abundance of fossils we find. And then in the middle and late Permian, they're replaced by the therapsids, and the therapsids dominate in the same way. So it's not until the middle Permian that reptiles really start diversifying, and it's not until the end Permian mass extinction that their diversity overtakes the therapsids.
So what was the transition between the therapsids and the pelicosaurs like? Did one just replace the other? Did they coexist peacefully for a while?
Well, they must have coexisted for the late Carboniferous and early Permian, because we have, remember I was talking earlier about ghost lineages, we have a therapsid ghost lineage stretching back into the Carboniferous. We just don't have the therapsid fossils themselves. So the transition between faunas that we can see dominated by pelicosaurs to the faunas dominated by therapsids occurs at the end of the early Permian. It's about 217 million years ago. And my diversity analysis shows that it's not a gradual transition. It's an actual mass extinction event. The diversity of synapsids seems to almost halve at this time. And other workers have seen similar diversity losses in various sauropsid groups and also amphibians. And one thing my diversity analysis suggested was that the extinction occurs in two phases. So during the early Permian, we have a fauna dominated by pelicosaurs, and in particular two families. We have the edaphosaurids being the dominant herbivores. They have these grinding tooth plates and a rather nifty forwards-backwards motion of the lower jaw to grind up plant material. And the large carnivores are another pelicosaur group, the sphenacodontids, which is the family that includes everyone's favorite Dimetrodon. And these two families and a couple of the other pelicosaur families die out completely across the boundary between the early and the middle Permian. But they aren't immediately replaced by therapsids. Instead, we find two different pelicosaur families show a very brief period of dominance. There's the varanopids, which sort of look a bit like monitor lizards, become the big terrestrial carnivores. They had been around in the early Permian, but only as small and medium-sized carnivores and insectivores. But at the start of the middle Permian, we see species up to 2 meters long. And then in the herbivorous corner, we find the caseids, which are really huge. They're up to 6 meters long and maybe weighing half a ton. And they have these big forelimbs, possibly for digging, that they have really tiny heads. And they were around in the early Permian, but were really not very diverse. But they show a sudden radiation at the beginning of the middle Permian. But then as we go further into the middle Permian, we get a second phase of the extinction where the caseids and the varanopids suffer a massive drop in their diversity and the therapsids radiate.
Have you any idea of the driving forces behind these?
Not really. This extinction has actually only been fairly recently recognised. It's been dubbed Olsen's extinction after Everett Olsen, who was... did a lot of work on the terrestrial ecosystems at this time. But as a mass extinction event, it was only really recognized in, I think, 2008 in a paper by Sarney and Benton. So it hasn't really been very strongly studied. There are environmental changes occurring at this time. We see further the trend of warming and drying. We see the rainforests around the equator completely disappear. A desert belt around the equator starts to expand. So we are seeing environmental changes at this time. Whether there's a link between them and the extinction, can't say.
So when did the pelycosaurs finally go extinct?
The last pelycosaur was a tiny little varanopid from South Africa, which lived about 260 million years ago. But by that time, the caseates and the varanopids had been on very low diversity for about 5 million years. This was a bit after their major radiation.
So in the Permian, we've got the general trend of the pelycosaurs losing out and the therapsids really making gains in their diversity. How did they fare towards the Permo-Triassic mass extinction?
In short, very badly. In the terrestrial realm, they appear to have been the hardest hit. They have an extinction rate of about 80%. We see the complete disappearance of some therapsid clades, like the saber-toothed carnivores called Gorgonopsians. And even groups which survive, like the Anomodonts, which are beaked herbivores, they show substantially reduced diversity, both in terms of species richness and morphological diversity. I mean, before the end Permian mass extinction, Anomodonts include a huge array of herbivores, like really big forms, there's small burrowing forms, there's, I think, an arboreal form called Tuminia. But after the end Permian mass extinction, they are all these large, possibly up to hippo-sized forms. We lose a lot of the diversity. And the sauropsid groups, the reptile groups, were hit as well by the end Permian mass extinction, but it seems to have been less severe than the synapsids, and they recover relatively rapidly. So we see in the aftermath of the extinction, the diversification of new reptile groups like the archosaurs, the group that contains crocodiles and dinosaurs, and the appearance of marine reptiles. The synapsids do show a recovery from the end Permian mass extinction, but it's slower. And then throughout the Mesozoic, they never really reach the diversity of the reptiles.
Why do you think they've survived so many mass extinctions?
Well, conventional wisdom will probably tell you it's all their mammal-like adaptations, like warm-bloodedness and the tooth differentiation and things like that, that make them more adaptable. This is debatable, as it's debated as to whether evolution in mass extinctions really works like that.
Could it just be luck?
It can just be luck, and there are quite a lot of people who do say survival of a mass extinction is largely luck, and there are other people who disagree. So this is a point of huge contention, and mass extinctions are bizarre and mysterious events, and we don't really have any complete idea about what triggers survival. There's loads of analyses into sort of how selective these mass extinctions are, and a lot of them do appear to be selective. But in a lot of cases, it's very difficult to say exactly why.
We've mentioned the sampling bias, but did your analysis reveal anything else?
Yeah, well, I mean, I mentioned the geographic bias, but there's another one that I've been particularly interested in. That is the completeness of the specimens themselves. It's something I was particularly interested in pelycosaurs. Obviously, it's the specimens themselves which determine how many species we will judge to be present, because we need good specimens to show the characters that will distinguish the specimens from each other. And this is actually a really complicated issue, because the effect it has on our estimates of diversity and species richness will vary depending on the paleontologist working on the group. So you may have some very careful workers who will not name very incomplete material if they can't see characters on it. So if you have a time period represented by lots of fragmentary material, there will be fewer species named in it. And on the other hand, there are workers who will name a new species based on every tiny little fragment of toe bone. So it's actually here that you can see a really interesting contrast in the history of discovery between, shall we say, dinosaurs and pelycosaurs. So dinosaur discovery has really accelerated in recent years alongside the development of cladistic methods, the methods for creating evolutionary trees. And when we look at the completeness of dinosaur specimens and estimates of their diversity through time, we see that the two correlate very strongly. Time periods with lots of good material, where we can see lots of good morphological characters, tend to have higher diversity estimates. So if the workers can't find characters, species don't get named as often. And a lot of the rubbish species have recently been re-evaluated and declared not valid. But in pelycosaurs, we actually see the opposite. There are loads of species named based on incredibly rubbish fossils, single skull bones, single vertebrae, what have you. And so we're actually finding higher estimates of diversity during times where we have more fragmentary specimens. And this, I think, is to do with the history of discovery. The greatest period of discovery of pelycosaurs is the period between 1940 and 1970, when a lot of species were named based on size and location and stratigraphy. And so a lot of descriptions we see at this time saying things like, species A is almost identical to species B, except it's older, or it's bigger, or it was found in New Mexico instead of Texas.
Have you managed to eradicate any species then?
Personally, no, but a lot of work is being done on that front. There's fairly recently a paper on Dimetrodon, which has looked at the tooth morphology of three different species and has found that there are actually differences. So those species may potentially be valid as they have very different patterns of serrations on their teeth. On the other hand, there's been some work on another group of pelycosaurs called the Hapsodontines in the 90s, which suggested that a lot of them were invalid, that they were a single species. So it's a work in progress, shall we say.
And then the other way, are you able to estimate how many species we've yet to discover based on your diversity estimates?
Well, this is difficult, and people have been trying to do this for a number of clades. One way to do it is to look at what we call collector's curves. These are curves which track the number of species known to us through research time. So we expect a curve to form a sort of S shape. So discovery is very slow at first, as we're just finding a few species and working out where they fit in the new clade and where we can expect to find them. But then discovery will accelerate. And then finally, as we reach the maximum knowable record, the rate of discovery will slow. And people have produced these curves for clades like dinosaurs, and they tend to show we're in the period of extremely rapid discovery, showing that there's still a lot more to find. But for pelycosaurs, the curve appears to be starting to flatten. So this may mean that there aren't that many more species yet to find. We are reaching the maximum knowable record of pelycosaurs. Alternatively, it may simply be a reflection of the lack of fieldwork in recent years. The vast majority of new species named in the last, should we say, decade or so, have been specimens that were found as far back as the 80s, or in some cases even further, but have just been sitting in drawers gathering dust until now that they are starting to be brought out and described. There hasn't really been very much fieldwork in early Permian terrestrial sites in recent years, as there has been in, say, the middle and late Permian of Africa.
That's a shame.
Yeah, it is. And, I mean, this is an effect, another bias that we have in the fossil record. So the bias is that certain workers won't put the same effort into studying rocks of different ages. So when we compare the number of species in a time bin to the number of collection efforts in that time bin, that is the number of times workers have gone into the field and looked at rocks of that age, we find the two correlate almost exactly. So, I mean, it may seem obvious to say that if you put more effort into studying rocks of this age, you will find more species of this age. But the correlation is really very strong and highlights really the need to do sampling correction. We can't just take the fossil record as it is.
I think the collector information also shows that there's a correlation between fossil sites and pubs, bars and pubs.
Yes, that is an interesting piece of work. And yeah, there's work by Alexander Dunhill, who suggested that simple accessibility of the fossil record, things like car parks nearby a fossil site, will improve the number of species found there.
Oh, wow.
So there's a lot of really weird but interesting things that can come out of looking at this. And things like soil cover, which, whether the rock is actually exposed or if it's covered by soil, that will affect it. So there's huge numbers of potential biases, and they do all need to be considered.
Do you get to go out in the field?
Personally, no. I'm not that big of a fan of field work. I'm different to a lot of paleontologists. I didn't have lots of fossil sites near me when I was growing up. I was very much of a townie, so I didn't spend my childhood ferreting around in the dirt finding fossils. My interest came almost entirely from reading, and I was always interested in the major events in life. So I continued this into my university period. I was a lot less interested in the field trips and a lot more interested in the methodologies paleontologists use to study the larger evolutionary patterns and the major events in life, like mass extinctions and major radiations and things like that. And I'm still a lot like that now. I'm less keen on going into the field and more keen on working on the evolutionary patterns and processes. And I obviously love studying fossils themselves, but my interest is always on what the fossil can tell us about the bigger evolutionary picture.
And what are some of the big questions still left to answer about synapsids?
Personally, I'd be really interested in finding out more about the demise of pelycosaurs and that extinction event, Olsen's extinction at the end of the early Permian. So I've looked at the changes in species richness at this time, but there's still loads more to do. As we spoke about before, we have no idea what caused it. We don't know yet what was happening in terms of morphological and ecological diversity at this time. What part did biogeographic factors play? How did the changing climate zones affect it? These are questions I'm really interested in asking.
And what could you say to encourage more people to start looking at early synapsids, opposed to dinosaurs or any other group?
Yeah, so I'd say there's... These are where we came from. These are the earliest steps on the lineage leading to mammals. And also, they are the most diverse, the most abundant fossils we find at this time. They are really important in terms of the ecosystems at their time. If we are going to understand early Permian and middle and late Permian ecosystems, we need to know what was happening in synapsid evolution at this time, because they were the dominant clade.
Well, Neil, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.
What's your favourite synapsid?
Well, this is something that's actually changed over the course of my PhD. I used to be really interested in the sphenacodontids, the clade that contains Dimetrodon, partly as a leftover from my childhood, obviously, as the first synapsid I ever knew, and partly purely because I'm very interested in carnivore evolution, and these were the first macro carnivores, the first terrestrial vertebrates to feed on large vertebrate prey. But over the course of my PhD, I've actually become a lot more interested in caseids. They're these really, really weird group which have these, they're huge. Some of them are the biggest terrestrial vertebrates around at that time. There's some up to 6 meters long and weighing 300 to 500 kilograms. But then there's this weird morphology where they have these tiny little heads. I think something like Cotylorhynchus, which is about 6 meters long, has a head that is probably smaller than me, mine. They're an early evolution of herbivory, which is also very interesting. They have an absolutely bizarre morphology. I'd be really interested in finding out more about exactly where this morphology came in and why it evolved.
That was going to be my second question. What's the weirdest?
It probably is the case here. Or if we go outside the pelycosaurs, I'd say probably the dinocephalians. They're really, really ugly. They're a therapsid group, and they have these weird horns and knobbles all over their heads. But what actually interests me a lot is their teeth. They have incisors, so their front teeth have these heels on the back, and the incisors occlude in such a way that the incisors interlock, and then these heels occlude, forming a grinding surface. So they actually have a grinding surface on their front teeth.
Hmm. So has there been any kind of guesses as to what they were eating?
They're carnivores and herbivores. There's a lineage called the antiosaurs within them, which were entirely carnivorous. And then there's the tapinocephalian lineage, which includes some carnivores and some herbivores. But they're large, so they're probably macro carnivores.